Okay, so my name is Saul Fagani. I wrote my paper on what criticizes the Akamai II Federal Circuit opinion. Specifically how, even though it closes the liability loophole for most general method patents, it still creates another one for interactive method claims. And before I get into like the main topics I want to talk about today, does anyone have any questions about the different ways that direct and indirect liability apply in unified patent infringement versus divided patent infringement? Perfect. So I'm just going to go straight to it then. So my paper talks about interactive method claims, which are essentially method claims that identify two or more actors that carry out the patented methods. And essentially, the classic example of this would be the Amazon.com one-click method method patent, which essentially divides the patented method between two different actors, one a server system and one a client system. And in layman's terms, essentially, the client would be you who goes on the website, and the first two steps of the patent would be you going on the website, identifying the product, clicking on the product. It displays that information to you. That's step one. Step two is when you guys see that little yellow button on the side that says one click, you clicking that button sends an order to Amazon. That's all that is required from the client server system. The server system itself receives that patent, receives that information in step one, step three. Step four, it goes in, retrieves all your collected like information such as your credit card, your address, everything else, and conveys it back to you so that you can actually purchase this thing in one click. And so that's like the classic interactive method claim. And so what Akamai 2 did was that it expanded the law of joint infringement liability by holding that inducement-only rule now provides that a single entity doesn't have to complete every single one of the claim steps. That as long as someone induces multiple people to infringe these method claims, that as long as each one of these claims is performed, that you're going to have inducement liability. So the issue with interactive method claims is that neither the single entity rule or the inducement-only rule apply over here. So it doesn't provide these patentees with a way of enforcing their patents. So as you guys saw, my first argument was that if you take the Amazon.com method patent, for example, you have a competitor like eBay that goes and all of a sudden puts their one-click purchasing method on their website, and so they did not perform arguably the last two steps of the patent method. But then they haven't gone and contracted with you. They haven't established a joint venture relationship with you. So now when you go on eBay's website, all you have to do is click on that item and purchase it. And even though the whole method has been completed, there isn't a direct infringer there. So direct infringement liability has been completely thrown out the window for these interactive method claims. So then the only only way you can even practically enforce these patents now relies on the inducement-only rule, which was the new rule established by Akamai 2. And in this way, interactive methods are difficult because inducement requires not only knowledge of the patent itself, you have to have knowledge that the inducer has to have knowledge of the inducee, all the acts that they're performing actually do violate the patent, and lastly, you have to have the specific intent to actually encourage or aid and abet that person's infringement. And so with interactive method claims, you receive an issue when there's most of them have very narrow patent specifications. So the inducer has to actually intend for the inducee to perform those very specific limitations. And so this results in a catch-22, as I explained, which essentially says that even though you're trying to draft your claim as narrow as possible to increase its patentability, it results by doing so, it makes it more difficult for you to actually enforce your patent. And I provided two examples from the Prometheus case in my paper, which were medical diagnostic treatment patents. And in the first claim, which was an independent claim, you saw a really broad patent claim that didn't really specify the amount of dosage or the frequency or anything else, just kind of set out all the different steps. But the dependent claim 3 essentially said the exact dosage, how often these treatment steps were supposed to be given, what was supposed to be communicated to the doctor from the pharmaceutical and via the hospital. And so when the inducer that basically goes and provides this diagnostic treatment and everyone else, kind of the doctors, the hospital, the pharmaceutical, all infringes patent, in the first claim, he's able to kind of prove the inducement because this is so general. But the second, it's hard for the patentee to prove that the inducer actually intended for the doctor to administer 60 cc's of thiospirin for the sleep apnea. And so in those situations, patentees are kind of stuck between risking drafting claims that might be rejected in an office action from the USPTO, rather than drafting claims that encompass the complete patentability of their invention and risk not being able to enforce them. And so Mark Lendley at UC, is a professor at UC Berkeley, he teaches a lot of patent courses there, criticizes the Akamai 2 decision itself because he feels like it bails out a lot of patentees who just draft really crappy patent claims. And then he says that a lot of these claims, not interactive method claims, but general method claims in itself, can be drafted in unitary form. And unitary form is essentially claims that are drafted from the perspective of a single actor. And the problem with interactive claims in this sense is that they can't be drafted in unitary form because there's no single hub. And a hub is an actor that performs at least one of the steps but has a substantial interaction with the remaining actors who complete the remaining steps such that the claim can be drafted from a single perspective. And so he gave an example of a patent that was issued to PayPal, which essentially was covered a method for securing communications of commercial transactions over the internet. And he showed how one of the claims was drafted from the perspective of like three or four entities, and the other one was drafted from a single party. And interactive method claims, the truly interactive method claims, they can't be drafted in this manner because the patentability or the novelty of the invention relies on the interactivity. And so this proper claim drafting solution is available to these entities. So basically they're stuck in a situation which a lot of people have deemed as the Akamai 2 loophole. And my paper proposes a solution which, instead of focusing on like, the rigid rules that the Federal Circuit has applied in the inducement-only rule and the single entity rule, I've gone ahead and looked at an older decision called the Golden Hours case, which was the only Federal Circuit decision to actually use like a factor analysis instead of like a rigid like compartmentalizing rule. And the first step of my proposed solution would, and this would all, of course, occur under the doctrine of direct infringement, would be for the court to first look at whether or not a nexus exists between the claim, the patent's interactivity and its patentability. And this would essentially mean that was the patent granted because the invention, because of the interactivity of the invention? Was it for that interactivity?
And, would it be a fair statement that the question is, could they have done what Mark Lendley wanted them to do?
No, that's what I'm getting to, is that if the answer is no, then you apply the single entity rule and the inducement only rule, and this is fair in this instance because they could have done what Mark Lendley had done. They could have drafted them in unitary form because they weren't truly interactive, and so it's their own fault, and I don't think the system should bail out people that poorly draft claims. And so if the answer is yes, that nexus does exist, and that then you look to the golden hour factors, which the first one would be whether a joint venture exists, and that would be like joint sales activity or like joint promotional activity. The second factor would be like whether the infringing entities engage in any kind of concerted action. And in the golden hour decision, for example, the two entities were independently selling their software products, but were offering it in a bundled package as well. And the court said that was a concerted action in that sense. And the third one would be whether or not the infringing entities kind of accrue any kind of benefit, whether it's financial, competitive, or commercial, from their infringement. And by kind of looking at these kind of factors, you step outside of the rigid rules of the Federal Circuit, and you're able to encompass situations where parties engage in arms-length transactions and still infringe patents without liability.
That's somebody over here with a question.
Yeah. If your proposed rule seems like, with all the number of factors that you're saying you take into account here, that provide very much a case-by-case analysis, right?
Exactly.
Do you think that's the most appropriate in this situation to have case-by-case instead of a bright-line rule?
I mean, the district courts still go through a case-by-case basis of the inducement. They still look at all the different factors, but because it's so rigid, they just like bypass things such as like concerted action and everything else. So they're still viewing the case as a whole on a case-by-case. But they're not looking at specific factors when they're weighing it out. So a lot of these cases, like Akamai, for example, was just drawing analogies in previous cases where they said, what is a single entity? You know, so they're still like looking at the facts of the case to draw that analogy.
But you think that fairness is more important than predictability? Obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even predictable in the first instance. I mean, no one, and that's actually interesting because I did a case, a research study, not research study, I researched the issue of how many decisions kind of used the inducement-only rule after Akamai 2, and I only found four cases that had actually had an unpublished decision on it, and they all dismissed the case in summary judgment. So I mean, no one knows how this rule is going to shape out to begin with. So there isn't a published decision that's applied it. So I mean, we're not losing predictability because it's still unpredictable.
I have another question also with the poorly drafted claims. Process patent drafting, it's a hard process, it takes a long time. Do you think that, you know, there should be some flexibility? Do you think it's, I was just wondering, maybe the counter argument would be, you know, you're saying, oh, well, I don't feel that people who make these patents that it's easy to make. Well, I think my point is that isn't it maybe harder than you're getting credit for to draft these claims?
No, I think so. I mean, I'm not a patent prosecutor, but I mean, I know a lot of people who are. This is like fundamentals that, like, with the case law, it's borderline malpractice nowadays to be able to, if the invention can be drafted in the unitary form, it should be in the unitary form, given the loophole liability right now, and the might have been doing your client service. And I think that a lot of these people get caught up on making a diverse patent portfolio and claiming an apparatus and different kind of method claims and having dependent claims that they neglect the fact that they could be drafted better to enforce the claim in the long run. Any other questions? That was a very exciting topic.
To what extent is, I'm wondering, patentability isn't really a bright line. That is, you don't know when you submit whether you get patented. So isn't there a problem with saying, we will decide which box you go into in terms of our legal rules according to what you could have done that would have gotten it past the PTO, when we don't really know what would have gotten it past the PTO? So that when I say, I drafted it this way because I believed that my chance of rejection would have been higher if I had drafted it in a unitary form, how is the court going to decide whether that's a legitimate claim or not?
You talk when they're applying my proposed standard. So, I mean, I assume that the court is going to be looking at intrinsic evidence only, so like the specification itself, the preferred embodiment, like the file wrapper, the patent prosecution history, and in those instances, they're just going to be looking at the transactions, the transmissions between the USPTO and the patentee, and if any prior art was disclosed in that sense that identified that, and whether or not, and which is most likely the case in an office action, and whether or not then the substance of the novelty became the interactivity itself rather than the invention, the claimed invention of like the diagnostic treatment.
So does this mean that what you really ought to be doing is making both a unitary and a non-unitary claim, and then if the unitary claim gets rejected and the non-unitary claim gets accepted, that demonstrates to the court that you couldn't make a unitary claim? Is that the implication for patent drafting?
That's one strategy I guess you could use. I don't know what the limitations are for that as far as what you can submit to the USPTO. I mean, they wouldn't conflict, so I don't see a problem with it.
Is what you're really proposing an employment act for patent lawyers?
I certainly wouldn't oppose to that.
Well, but what do you in fact think, if you ask the question from those of us who aren't patent lawyers, are you raising the total amount of litigation, which is my real point, by putting in your rule?
I mean, I think I'm just, I think patents are going to get litigated regardless, right? You're still going to have these patent trolls, you're going to have these old claims of that, such as this one. But that wouldn't be the situation over here because you're assuming that these patents, there's no incentive for these patents to get filed in the first place for interactive method claims without such protection, right? So I'm assuming that the court needs to find a reasonable balance between enforcing patent claims for interactive method claims and also protecting innocent infringers. Because if you have what the court decides, which is a rigid rule that focuses on a strict relationship, then what's going to happen is that it's going to protect innocent infringers, but it's going to be neglecting the fact that these patentees who spent all this time and money going through the patent prosecution process, they have no longer an incentive, especially since their method claims. They don't have an incentive to claim the method. Why don't they just claim the apparatus as the method of trade secret? And so I think it's just reinforcing the patent system in general.
One of the things I wondered about actually reading the paper is one interpretation of when people say trade secrets work for us better than patents do. One explanation is patents work badly for us, and the other is trade secret works well for us. And it would seem to me that if my method is a method for making something inside my factory,
mm-hmm.
that's fairly easy to keep secret.
Yeah.
Just as if what I'm patenting is a chemical, it's impossible to keep it secret, because once the chemical's out, people can analyze it. But it would seem to me that the kind of things you're discussing, your interactive things, are exactly the sort of thing that's very hard to keep a secret.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way Amazon can keep secret while 53 million people are using their one-click system.
Well, that's what I was
but if that's right, if it's hard to keep it secret, mm-hmm. then if you think of the patent law as having two different functions, one of them is to encourage innovation, and the other is to discourage secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if the secrecy is not an option for the things you're discussing, that reduces the importance of patent law.
No, I was talking about the general fact is that if you have an apparatus that you're patenting, the only reason that you wouldn't discourage patenting the method would be that if the apparatus in itself contained was able to not be reverse engineered, right?
Yes.
And so these interactive methods, since they require multiple entities, there's no real product to be reverse engineered, so they require that.
Therefore, there's no need to worry that failing to protect them will result in their being secret.
So
they worry that failing to protect them will result in their not happening, but you don't have to worry that failing to protect them will result in their being kept secret. No.
So when an author, James Yoon, who did a paper with Brian Lovell on this, had a discussion, and they were saying that not only would this, in that sense, but people would be less willing to invest in interactive technologies, right? So you have people who have started businesses who rely on small little incremental inventions that rely on interactivity, who receive VC funding and be able to patent that invention, that market would disappear.
On the other hand, they'd be more willing to fund things that weren't depending on patent and were depending on interactive technology, because the risk that your interactive technology would get you sued would be less. That is, you were the one who raised the idea of patent trolls, and if you're really worried about patent trolls, you ought to want to make patent law weaker, not stronger, shouldn't you?
And it puts me out of a job, though, so...
Yeah.
Any other questions? Yes. It's an older opinion, and it's been superseded by BMC. It was at a point where the court was still trying to struggle, finding that right balance between like protecting inventors and innocent infringers. And that court went the other way, right? They protected patentee more, but the issue became that kind of like what he was implying was that the courts were kind of stuck because they didn't have like a formal structure like this, kind of only this weird factor analysis. They didn't look at the interactivity of it. A lot of courts were stuck kind of cutting out innocent infringers out of the scenarios of like strict liability. So that was the drawback of one that, because it didn't focus only on interactivity, it focused on general patent methods.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering,
so a lot of people like are upset at Akamai 2 Court because it kind of manifests its like doctrine out of nowhere, right? And the single entity rule, which is the BMC court, which overruled Golden Hours a while back, limited direct infringement to instances where one entity controls the other infringing entities to such an extent that they're viewed as a single entity, and a predicate to finding in indirect liability, which is inducement, would have required to have every single step performed by a single entity as well. So, like, direct infringement was a live predicate to indirect infringement, which seems weird. But they had to do that way technically because it was all under the doctrine of direct infringement.
Got another question over there.
Yeah.
One of the basic premises of your paper is that this loophole that you're talking about, that the processes that you're talking about, that they're worthy of protection, that we need to protect them through patents. Do you think that if we don't, and that we've been operating under this prior system for a while now, do you think that Amazon, as you're talking about, the one patent system, can still develop this, even though they don't have this protection? Why do you think it would make the incentives that Dr. Friedman was talking about better with your rule?
If you look at, like, if you step back and look at the amount of claims that actually fall under the ones that I'm talking about, it's very minimal, right? It's people that not only that have these, like, interactive claims, but they also have to be very specific and narrow limitations. I'm assuming that the number of patents that actually the novelty relies on the interactivity would be minimal. And so I don't think there's any widespread harm to the system right now, and I think all the points are well taken. I just thought it was interesting because over the summer I had to write an opinion paper on non-infringement, which dealt with Akamai, and I had no idea that this loophole existed because we were just counseling our client to do all this, and he would not be liable for infringement. And I just thought it was interesting, so I thought it warranted a paper in this class.
Thank you.
So I think it's very minimal.
Thank you. Next paper?
Perfect. Thank you.
Now, am I misremembering, apropos of the question you were just asking, but weren't you the one who described the situation as a crisis in your paper?
Yeah.
Right. And you've just been explaining why it's not really a crisis at all, why it's a trivial little problem. I always get suspicious when people use terms like crisis.
Yeah, it was a...
Because it sounds as though they're trying to...
Scaremonger?
That's right, to make you not actually think about the thing by treating it as much more important than it is. There's a story I'm very fond of that after one of the American victories of the American Revolution, when the news got to Scotland, one of Adam Smith's students told him, "Mr. Smith, this will be the ruin of England. Young man, there's a lot of ruin in a nation."
Yeah.
Continue. All yours.
So, my paper was focused on... actually this topic as well, the issue that's come up into the courts between having a direct infringement rule with patents versus having this induced infringement rule. And I didn't want to talk, as Dr. Friedman was saying, about a summary of my paper when I was up here, but I just took some time to think about some of the issues and maybe some counterarguments to my points and what I think, and these are three different issues that I've thought about. First, one of the main premises in my paper is that this kind of reform should be done through Congress, not through the courts. And that's one of the main reasons the dissenters dissented in their opinion, because as the previous speaker was saying, they kind of created and invented this new rule of induced infringement for patents. And I think that the Congress is better suited to dealing with this problem because, for one thing, they have more experience working with the businessmen, with the consumer groups, with the inventors in this field, and they have the ability to hold hearings and to be able to fix this problem better. But I was kind of thinking, you know, with the current state of the way Congress is right now, that they seem to be unable or unwilling to fix the problems. Is it better for the courts to go in and bend the statute to maybe slightly legislate, but for the greater good of the system? And I was wondering what your guys' opinion on what that was.
I'm sorry, could you ask
for
the question again? Is it better for the courts to be stepping in and
instead of Congress? Yeah.
Instead of Congress? I think, you know, I think like the Federal Circuit Court, like when they, I think there are some judges who hear a lot of the cases and they have a better background. I think in general what I kind of think is a problem is where you get judges deciding these very complicated cases that don't have any scientific background.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that can be problematic. But that's just sort of a problem of how it's system is set up. I don't know that Congress is necessarily more capable in that respect. However, I kind of think there maybe should be like a third party like panel of scientists. That's kind of my personal opinion. But I think with the judiciary, like maybe you know, if it's particularized to like one court that hears more cases, like D.C. Circuit, that they might. But that's not really true of all uniformly for all the circuits. So.
I mean, I agree. I think that I kind of think the opposite point that judicial activism is warranted here, not only because I think Congress will take forever to come up with a solution to this issue, but Judge Newman, for example, was saying in the dissenting opinion that the judges were the ones that haven't dealt with these issues, even though they don't have a technical background, they know what all these legal implications of such a standard would be, and what it would mean for patentees or infringers on both sides. I just think that some kind of equitable doctrine, or some kind of solution or interpretation of the patent law would not only be faster implemented, but it would be surefire way of actually being a solution that would stand alone.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to argue against you, Jerry. There's nothing that prevents the Congress or legislature from actually appealing to judges in order to get input as to what would be more effective in legislation. I mean, the other issue is we have a series of judges is each individual judge can make their own determination, and they aren't necessarily bound to follow the same set of rules or come to the same sort of conclusion. A statute is different because people are, I mean, there still can be divergent interpretations, but everyone's going to be using the same standard even if they interpret it slightly different. So it's probably more likely to have a uniform outcome if they're actually changing because of the actual statutes.
Your predecessor told us what he thought the courts should do. Yeah. What do you think Congress should do? So you have now been hired by a congressman who says, I understand there's this problem and you're an expert on it, and I'd like to draft a statute which will solve this terrible crisis of people infringing a very narrow subset of patents.
Well, I think that Congress should step in and they should create a specific claim for infringement under process patents. I think that the way that they should do that is, one, an important thing of that patent would be that the remedy would focus solely on the main infringer and not on other parties, because one of the main concerns of the dissenters in the Comey case and in the majority in BMC is that you'd have these consumers who do not know what's going on, aren't as tech savvy, but are using these products and are infringing that they could possibly become enwrapped. So as part of the statute, I make it so that the one that is inducing the infringement, the main infringer, I'd say the organizer or the inducer similar to a Comey standard would be the main one that would be liable. I'd also think that another way to do it would be maybe instead of just having a lawsuit, because one of the things that came up to my mind was, you know, maybe there's other ways to deal with this than just through legal methods. Maybe we could create a system where you have a person who creates a patent would be reviewed by a committee, and then that process would become open, because as the previous speaker was saying, many of these patents are absolutely required on being public and being out there, and it's hard to keep them secret, and that it might be more effective to just say, okay, well, these are hard to protect, we want to protect these consumers, we want to give these rights, so we have some sort of licensing system where we decide an amount that could be used for this, because they do have value, even though they're hard to do.
I'm not sure I understand your proposal. You're talking about compulsory, about giving a patent and then having a compulsory license?
Yeah.
Why is a compulsory license any more appropriate in this case than any other? Why is it especially relevant to this issue? That's the issue we were discussing before, is what does or doesn't infringe your patent.
Yeah.
And I don't see how having compulsory licensing.
Well, I would say that it wouldn't be so much like a you know, that's something I have to think about.
And yeah. How clear is it that all such cases have a single main infringer? That is, the particular case where I've got a website and you're clicking on it, maybe does. But if you think about it, can you imagine other cases that would come in the same area where arguably there would be two or where there wasn't a one-many kind of distinction?
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that where you're involving, like with credit card companies where you're dealing with a business and as well as the financial institutions that are working together. So it would be hard to have a single main infringer in those kinds of cases.
Other questions? All right, we all go home a little early.